Welcome now to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the monthly collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT and the Chicago Public Library at the Harold Washington Library Center. Victoria Lautman's program this month features Jet McInerney in an interview recorded earlier this week. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at MavenChronicles.com. A proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Seminary Co-op bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually three Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend The Hindus, an Alternative History, by Wendy Doniger, published by Penguin Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring family properties, race, real estate, and the exploitation of black urban America by Beryl Satter, published by Metropolitan Books. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. There, you're invited to discover The Library at Night by Alberto Mangel, new in paperback from Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. And at semcoop.com.
Thank you. Thank you. What a terrific crowd. Thank you and welcome to Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman here at the Harold Washington Library. Of course, is our ongoing partnership with 98.7 WFMT Radio. I'd like to thank the MavenChronicles.com. They continue to support this series in their second season of it. But we are in our fifth season, and we like to continue to have support into the future. So I always like to thank them. Also, thank you to Seminary Co-op Bookstore, who continue to schlep and haul all of these tomes down here. Be sure you buy everything on their table so they don't have to haul them back to Hyde Park. There will be questions at the end of the show. Of course, you know that, so start thinking of them now. We will take a short break halfway through. Don't leave. I'll notice it. But the reason we're here today, you know, it is virtually impossible to introduce my guest, Jay McInerney, without invoking this whole slew of words and situations and illegal substances that I know he is so tired of hearing about. And when you start to read every introduction to him and they all say the same thing, they're to be avoided at all costs. So let's leave it at this. 25 years ago, it's hard to imagine, a quarter of a century ago, Bright Lights, Big City was published, which effectively launched Jay McInerney into the stratosphere in more ways than one. But you know, what followed were six more novels and two collections of wine essays and lots of stories for New York Magazine, The New Yorker, The Guardian, Harper's, lots of places. Plus there was a screenplay, a movie, and most recently, a small part in the hit show Gossip Girl. But now we have the new and collected stories in How It Ended, 26 stories in all. They span 26 years. And whether or not you followed McInerney through his literary career and the dazzling number of his appearances in places like the New York Post or on Gawker or the dozens of social outlets where he appears, you will...
Not willingly, necessarily.
You are really going to enjoy this collection of stories. It is a great pleasure to welcome back Jay McInerney. Thank you.
Thanks, Victoria.
About that, not willingly, but we'll get into that later. It doesn't even really matter. Although I do have to say that I did a comparison of your how they described you on page 6 in the New York Post versus the Gawker, and it's very clear that they love you at the New York Post. And this one guy, what is his name
at the
Josh Stein at the Gawker. I had to write down some of these descriptions. I wasn't going to use this unless I ran out of things to say. But as long as we're on that topic. Deeply repellent, semi-simian, dissipated wunderkind, and finally he called you a food blogger, which I thought was really low. That's on Gawker, well, but they love you at the Post, and we love you here.
Well, thanks for quoting that Gawker stuff. something I actually don't read myself.
And now you don't need to. It was amusing. But, you know, you were here 3 years ago. Some of you might remember his appearance here exactly 3 years ago for the really fantastic book. I so enjoyed it, The Good Life. And I know that you remember that as one of your finest moments of interviews ever. But
indeed.
Since that time, there's been a lot of changes in the world, in your life. And the one I would point out here before we actually get into something more substantial than this banter is that at the time we talked about the fact that you're third marriage was over, but now you have a fourth marriage, and you just kind of snuck off and did that right in between these, not long after that interview, you boom, we got married again. So now we can say the four-time married Jay McInerney.
Shortly after that interview.
Yes.
Well, and I proposed shortly after that interview.
Did the interview have anything to do with it? Did you propose in Chicago?
No, I proposed in Paris, actually.
Well,
I thought it was
it's like Chicago.
I thought it was a game.
We have Grand Boulevards here.
Good food in both places. grand architecture, yeah. Lots of similarities.
I can't actually...
Funny accents.
Oh, he's getting back at me for the Gawker quotes. Well, this book, which is really a treat, covers 26 years, 26 stories in 26 years. It's such a fascinating thing to read following your last outing here for The Good Life. And I guess my real question was why I thought, and you can hear it in this interview from 3 years ago, although you deny it now, that you were actually working on another novel. And so I was sort of thinking, oh, Jay's going to write another novel. But instead we've got this collection of stories. And so I was curious about why this collection now, and how did your decision to, gee, I'm going to collect my stories now come about?
Well, one of the things that happened was that after I published my last novel, The Good Life, I was casting around for my next project. I must have been lying to you when I told you I was working on a novel, because I don't think I was. Or maybe I was for a day or two. You know, I mean, I'm always thinking about it. But I feel very guilty whenever I'm not working on a novel, so I usually say that I am.
I'll remember that in the future. So if you say that today, I'll know what to think.
But in this case, I actually started reading a lot of short stories right around that time. And one of the projects that I undertook was to reread the work of Raymond Carver, who was my teacher at Syracuse University, in the graduate program. I actually left New York in 1981 to go to Syracuse, not an easy thing to do if you're someone who loves New York. Syracuse is not the garden spot of the world. But I was very lucky. In addition to Carver, I also got Tobias Wolff in the bargain. He had just published his first novel, or his first collection, called In the Garden of the North American Martyrs. And so here I was at Syracuse studying with these two masters of the short story form. Carver really became my mentor and friend, and we became very close until his death in, I believe, 88, at which point I couldn't read his stories for many years. It just made me too sad. I just couldn't go back to them. And after The Good Life, I did go back, and I reread all of his stories, and it just excited me, and it kind of challenged me. And then I started reading. I went back and reread Cheever's stories, and some of the and some of the stories that Carver had turned me on to, some of the stories that I had read with him at his suggestion and in his classes. And I suddenly thought, you know, I've been writing stories on and off for all these years, but I've never really sat down and concentrated on the form since I was in graduate school. And I love short stories, and I just thought, I'm going to sit down and write a collection of stories. It mutated a little bit along the way, because originally I signed a contract with my publisher for a collection of 10 or 12 new stories. But once I had finished those, I actually wrote them in a kind of a burst of about 6 months. I think it was my editor who suggested that maybe I ought to collect my earlier stories as well. And that's how this volume came into existence. It is a new and collected stories.
They're arranged in an order that you must have thought very hard about, but they're not chronological. And it was very interesting to go through them. And when I was reading the advance edition, there's no dates on them. There's no way to know which was written when.
Oh, yeah, because the book, the finished book, has the date.
The dates at the end of them, yeah. But and so there are things from the beginning of your career, and the most recent, I think, was from 2008.
Yeah, it's funny. Janet Maslin, in an otherwise favorable review, was indignant that they were not in chronological order. I was looking for a kind of a rhythm. I was looking for a progression. I was trying to shape the collection in such a way that the stories kind of bounced off each other and followed in some sort of interesting sequence. And the very first story in the book is the first story I ever published. But other than that, it's not strictly chronological.
No,
the dates are there if you want to place them.
It makes it interesting in certain contexts, which we can go into later. But the thing that I liked about it is that because they're not in chronological order, I guess it's like the third or fourth, or maybe it's even the fifth story in, I was reading before the hardcover came out. And it's a story called In the Northwest Frontier Provinces. And I thought, now this is, it takes place in this tiny village of Landikotal. And yes. And it was, I was thinking that this is a really, there's so much about this story which is like Jay McInerney, but there's so much that is not at all what we have come to realize is Jay McInerney's voice. And then reading back to your introduction, I see that story is actually the one that, as you were still a graduate student at SUNY, I mean at Syracuse, you had just decided to send off to the Paris Review.
Yeah, well, this is a story I wrote, I guess, in 1982, and I just sent it off blindly to the Paris Review. I didn't know anybody there, and it was just a submission to what we call the slush pile. And so I was astonished a few weeks, if not a few months later, to get a phone call from George Plimpton.
Who was your hero,
him. He was, this sort of silvery patrician voice that I kind of recognized from, his movie roles. And, Jay McInerney, please. And I thought somebody was pulling my leg, but indeed it turned out to be George Plimpton. And he told me that they liked the story quite a bit, but before he decided whether or not he was going to publish it, he wanted to see if I had anything else. And so I went through, that night, I went through everything that I had written up to that point, and I realized that it was all derivative drivel, basically. In any given chapter or story of my earlier work, I could see who I'd been reading that week, basically. Here was the Robert Stone week, and here was this was when I had been reading Ann Beattie and so on, but there was one paragraph in this filing cabinet of mine that struck me as original and fresh, and it was a paragraph that I had written after a sort of disastrous night on the town in New York City a few months before. I'd come home about 4 a.m. and I'd scrawled these lines down. And the first line, which has remained unchanged, was, "You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are." And there were a few more lines, and they were all written in the second person. And I remembered that I had been at this nightclub trying to decide whether or not to go home, possibly in an altered state of mind. And I caught myself talking to myself in the mirror, saying something like, "You're not the kind of guy who'd be at a place like this at this time of the morning." And I realized, I don't know, it's just, I thought, wow, yeah, here I am talking to myself in the second person. Although, in fact, that is how we tend to talk to each other, although it's not often, you know, exploited in literature. But you don't look in the mirror and say, "I idiot." You look in the mirror and say, "You idiot, what are you doing here?" And that was pretty much what I was saying. And when I got home, finally, I wrote this down. So here I was with this paragraph scrawled on an envelope, and I felt this was the only thing that sounded possibly like a fresh and original voice that might even be my own. And I spent the rest of the night writing a story in that voice. And I finished it about 6 or 7 in the morning, and I immediately sent it off to the Paris Review. And fortunately, George Plimpton called about a week later and said he loved it, and they were going to publish it. And that's the first story in this collection. And it's pretty much, I really haven't touched it since. It's as written in a sort of caffeine-fueled sprint of 7 or 8 hours.
But that's not what I wanted you to read.
Ah.
But thank you for going into that. That was my second question. After you read from the one that you originally sent him, which is called In the Northwest Frontier Province.
Okay.
You got ahead of me, but that's okay.
That was the
because this could have been
the
your
story
first published
that
work.
Earned me the call from the Paris Review. And I almost, it's funny, I was trying to decide whether or not to include it, and my editor, Gary Fiskerjohn, felt very strongly that it belonged in this collection. It's certainly the first story I wrote that I would have included here. I should mention that the Northwest Frontier Province, it was part of the hippie trail back in I passed through there in 1979. After I graduated from college, I missed the '60s, but I wanted to be part of the '60s, and I was trying as hard as I could to be a hippie, and part of it meant going to Asia and, you know, going through Thailand and Pakistan and India, and this story also has a little bit of resonance now in that the Northwest Frontier Province is the place that is giving us so much trouble now. It is the place most likely where Osama bin Laden is hiding, and where the Taliban have regrouped, and so on. Even then, it was a very scary and lawless place, and that was one of the things that made me interested in writing about it. Do you want me to?
I want you to read it. Okay. I still want you to read it.
Okay. I get distracted there for a minute. "And where is your beautiful wife this fine day?" the Pathan asked when Trey found him at his stall in the bazaar. The woman in question was not his wife, and by his lights it wasn't much of a day. No wind, the sun a degree higher in the sky and hotter than it had been this time the day before, and still no sign of Rudy. The Pathan's question had an ironic tone, as if the man understood all of this. But then he always sounded that way to Trey, who replied that Michelle was back at the fort, where she was relatively safe from lecherous Pathans. This was meant to be a joke, but the anxiety of waiting 2 weeks in a place where he didn't want to be put a sharper edge on the words than he'd intended. The Pathan quit smiling. Something bumped Trey's thigh. He looked down and saw a sheep nosing at his jeans. The animal then turned and waddled off down the bazaar, poking into stalls as if it were shopping. He had insulted the Pathan, a stupid thing to do. Their sense of honor was extremely delicate, their sense of redress extreme. They killed each other over such matters. Here in the hills between Pakistan and Afghanistan, the code of tribal honor blood relation and vendetta was the only law that was ever enforced. Bataan tribesmen with Enfield rifles strapped over their shoulders and bandoliers of ammunition wrapped around their baggy shirts strutted past the stall, and the man he was talking to had a revolver holstered on his hip. "You have heard from your friend," the Bataan said after a minute. Trey shook his head, relieved that his indiscretion had been passed over. "He was not Australian. No, Scottish." "Ah," the Bataan nodded. "There is an Australian passport for sale." It took a minute to sort this out and to construe the warning. Trey thought he knew where the passport had come from. A few days before, he'd met an Australian in the bazaar who'd mined opals in the outback for 2 years. He had a dry, brick-red tan against which his green eyes and the gaudy opal pendant on his chest glistened. Over kebabs, he told Trey, who hadn't asked, that he was in Landi Kotal to score hash oil. He was going to swallow it in condoms just before he flew out of Karachi. When he finished talking, he beamed as if he were the first person to have penetrated the mystery of demand and supply. Trey felt obliged to tell him that it was an old trick and that people had died in the bargain. Any residual alcohol that hadn't been boiled off in the processing of the oil would eat through the condoms, and once that happened, it was permanent deep space. But the Australian smiled and rubbed the opal on his chest. "My lucky amulet," he said. Trey had left him licking chili sauce from his cracked lips, and yesterday had seen the opal pendant for sale at a stall in the bazaar. He felt awful then, thinking that he might have been more sympathetic, more persistent. It was an object lesson, he told himself. The Bataan was reminding him of what could happen. "Excuse me," Trey said. "My humor was crude."
Jay McInerney reading for his new book, How It Ended, New and Collected Stories. Your very first story, not your first published story, but the one that you said led to really the rest of your career. And I was reading that thinking, what are the elements in this that we think of as Jay McInerney? And really, because they're all so finely observed, all of your stories have this incredible, almost, you know, journalistic eye for just observation, really, in detail. And, of course, there's drugs, and there's a gorgeous woman, and it ends really badly for just about everyone. And
By the way, I know who I was reading when I wrote that story.
I was going to ask you.
I mean, Robert Stone, Graham Greene. There's a little Hemingway in there. You know, that was a story definitely written with this sort of whole, you know, expatriate literary tradition in mind. I'm proud of that story. I think it was a good story, and I'm glad that my editor made me include it. And it seems to be eliciting some favorable comment. I had frankly forgotten it existed until he pulled it out of his drawer. He's a better record keeper than I am.
Well, this is Gary Fiskett, John, who you went to Williams with,
yes.
And who has read every single word of everything you've ever written. So I'm glad that he's there as your kind of angel on your shoulder, I suppose.
One of the problems with moving so many times and being married so many times is that you tend to, like, you know, not be a really great custodian of your own stuff.
Well, thankfully, he's there to remind you. But, you know, it did make me wonder when you were lying, when you were placing these stories out and trying to figure out which ones were going in and just grouping new ones and ones that go back to a past that you barely even remember, I guess, that one. And the kind of surprises that must have, you know, elicited from you. Just it must have been almost like looking at an old family album, and you think, oh yeah, God, I remember that cousin. Geez, I wonder whatever happened to her.
Yeah, a few of them I had kind of forgotten about. This is because some of them go back to, you know, some of them were published in magazines, say in the late '80s, and I just hadn't really thought about them since. And who knows? There may be one or two that we forgot. There were one or two that I decided not to include. Well, let's say three, because I just didn't think they held up. But on balance, of the older stories here, there are, I guess, 14 older stories, and 14 out of 17 still looked pretty good to me.
I think one of the things that people who are really familiar with all of your books and stories and your whole output are going to find in this is the fascinating connection between your stories and your subsequent novels. And I think more than just about any author that I can think of, which doesn't mean much because I'm probably not thinking of everybody who fits the bill, but you do really use these almost as like a proving ground for things. I mean, you described it actually as they're more like a one-night stand, and sometimes you just got to have one before you make a commitment. Those were your words.
A novel is more like a marriage, you know? I mean, it's a little daunting to just sit down in front of the computer one day and say, okay, now I know what I'm going to do with the next 3 years of my life. Here I go. My last novel took about 3 years, and that's a big commitment. So sometimes I find it helpful to fool myself into thinking that I'm just doing something much shorter, and I suppose it must be like an artist doing a sketch before he commits to a huge oil painting.
But do you know, at what point do you know, for instance, that, there's so many in this book. You've mentioned already at 6 a.m. do you know where you are, and that becomes Bright Lights, Big City. Of course, the story of my life is present in your work in three separate dates. 1987 was the first story that appears in this book that was first published, which then was turned into the novel in 1988. And then there's another kind of revisit of the same character, Allison Poole, in a story from 2008, one of the most recent ones, Penelope on the Pond. So in that case, you've taken a story, made it into a book, and then gone back to a story form.
And curiously enough, I mentioned Brett Easton Ellis earlier. Brett borrowed that character for two of his novels. Allison Poole nearly gets killed by Patrick Bateman, the psycho killer in American Psycho, just narrowly escapes getting killed. And then she featured fairly prominently in his next novel, Glamorama.
As a real skank. So I mean, he just like appropriated this and made her even skankier.
I know. I was a little upset by that, you know?
But what if he had killed her? Then what would you have... That would have been the end of your character? I mean, it's a terrible way to ruin somebody's career.
Maybe the end of our friendship. I don't know. I think this is partly Brett's way of poking fun at the critics who insist that we're so alike, something that we don't particularly feel ourselves, although we're good friends. I think our writing is pretty different. But I think this is a sort of intertextual joke on Brett's part. There are other recurring characters in this book as well, and most notably this couple that.
No, wait, we cannot talk about them. You can't talk about them yet.
Okay.
Do you mind?
No, because I can see you've got this mapped out here.
I try not to map it out too much, but this is what happened before with Mary Gates going. I cannot deviate too much from the map. but because also I'm not done with that question of what the relationship is for you between a story and the novel, because there are other stories in here, like Reunion, for instance, from 1986. Mm-hmm. And that, do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
You're looking off to the side like, where's Gary Fitzgerald when I need him?
That was a very early story. 86. Yeah.
But it's a wonderful, complex story about this family. Every family in here is just so messed up and decayed and infighting. But the character...
Well, you know what Tolstoy said.
Yes, but go ahead.
All happy families are alike. I mean, and not very interesting at that, but...
But this was, I mean, they're just, I was reading.
I mean, in fictional terms.
Yes, right, of course.
In dramatic terms, yeah.
But I guess I was wondering why some of these characters, and maybe you can't even answer this, some of them really grab you and you want to continue with, and other ones, like that family dynamic and the characters in that story, Ginny, the matriarch of that story, at some point you just decide, well, that was enough. I've had enough of these people.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Sometimes a story is enough, and sometimes I'm inspired by an anecdote, which then becomes maybe the central dramatic episode of a story. I don't always know if something is going to be story-sized or novel-sized, and sometimes I have to... Sometimes I just have to plunge in and see. But in the case of the news stories, I really felt they were all stories, and I think they all shall remain stories. And I like to think that means I'm actually learning something about the short story form. But But in the case of many of these others, I just didn't know. I really didn't know when I started them that they would, in fact, that they might grow into novels. It's always a sort of a question of feeling my way, I guess. I wish that I was one of those writers who just, you know, had it all mapped out in his head when he started. Fitzgerald, you know, was a big outliner and planner. John Irving, you know, has it all figured out before he even sits down. He knows how his books are going to end, he told me once. But for me, it's a sort of driving in the dark proposition, you know, and I can just see as far as the headlights, basically.
Now, I don't know if you consciously decided to sort of segue away from Story of My Life and Penelope on the Pond, but before I allow you to do that, and before we take a break, I'm bringing you back because...
Yes, I was trying to divert you and distract you.
You can't. It's just not possible. I mean, it is briefly, but we have to get back to that because we all know now, because you have been in the news a lot with your character, Allison Poole, who, it turns out, was a former flame from many years ago, who turns out to be based on the character of, it's Riley Hunter, I think it's pronounced.
It's pronounced Riel.
Riel, okay. Riel, I was told Riley by somebody else, but Riel Hunter.
No, I've heard Riley, but it's
but when
not
you,
the case.
When you went out with her, she was actually Lisa Druck.
Yeah.
So for those of you who are not up on your back issues of People magazine.
And good for you if you're not, by the way. I'm very proud of those of you.
Riel. Was the lover of John Edwards, who subsequently had a baby. And you were fascinated enough by that situation to then go back, re-examine this character who you'd written about when she was age 20, then make a book out of her, then she's practically murdered by Bret Easton Ellis, and then you look at her again in 2008, imagining how she is, you know, 20 years later as the lover of a senator.
Yeah, this will probably be my most controversial move in this book. But in fact, I mean, since you've dragged this out into the light of day,
you can make it brief.
I will tell you the story, which is that a few years ago, she moved back to New York from Los Angeles, and we got back in touch, and we became friends again. Not that we'd ever been unfriendly. But, you know, have lunch, have dinner once in a while. And then she basically disappeared. I had some vague notion as to why she might have disappeared. I thought that she was having a rather... I knew she was having an affair with someone. And so I was out of touch with her for about 8 months. And during that time, I kind of... speculated. I decided to try and imagine in fictional form, you know, where she was and what she was doing. Of course, I had some clue, and the National Enquirer was calling me most of this period too, because they felt that I might know something. In fact, I didn't really, but I wrote this story speculating about where my friend had disappeared to, and I also like the idea of revisiting Allison Poole and imagining her 20 years later.
I hope we get to see her again when she's a grandmother. But at the moment, we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back in just a little while with Jay McInerney talking about his new book, How It Ended. And you're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Laubman. Please do not go away. Thank you.
You're also listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and our monthly broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Laubman. This interview was recorded earlier this week at the Harold Washington Library in the Cindy Pritzker Auditorium. This broadcast is made possible in part by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. And by MavenChronicles.com. Find out what people are thinking about and recommending at MavenChronicles.com. Maven Chronicles defines Maven as a trusted expert in a particular field who seeks to pass knowledge on to others. At Maven Chronicles, they passionately distribute advice and insight to all with links to monthly features, guest contributors, financial features, travel tips, and more. Visit often to see what the Mavens have to say at mavenchronicles.com, a proud supporter of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
And welcome back. I'm Victoria Lautman talking to Jay McInerney about his new book, How It Ended, New and Collected Stories. Of course, Jay McInerney is also the writer of Bright Lights, Big City, Story of My Life, Brightness Falls, The Good Life, Model Behavior. There's so many more. Before we get back to him, I want to remind you that coming up in the rest of the season of Writers on the Record next month, May 21st, Eric Bogosian will be here talking about his new novel, followed in June by Monica Ali. Then we'll take a little break, and starting in September with our sixth season, Richard Russo will be back with, will be here with a brand new novel. Also, you can hear all of the past interviews, including Jay McInerney's earlier one from 3 years ago, where you can hear him lying about the novel he's working on at victorialautman.com, along with his friend Brett Easton Ellis, separate, talking about Lunar Park. That was a great interview. Augustine Burroughs, Andrea Barrett, Anne Lamott, Martin Amis, Russell Banks, many, many more to while away your time and perhaps make you go to sleep.
I hope you talked about me with Lunar Park. You know I was in it.
Yes, you were. You certainly were, and I heard you were not. See, now you're bringing up these things that you don't, are not even happy about. You were mad at him for putting you in there.
No, that's his.
Snorting coke off a car.
No, that's his story.
I mean, when would you ever do anything like that?
I was a little nonplussed when I first read it, but I actually think it's. He pointed out that I got a lot of good lines, and who knows?
That may be
what I'm remembered
for. Was there a pun there? Good lines? What do you mean? It was a good pun. Okay, enough about Brett. We're talking about you. This is how people conflate the two of you, because they're going to hear Brett, they're going to hear Jay, they're going to hear Coke, and then we get into trouble.
All right.
So back to the story.
Let's just talk about me and Scott Fitzgerald.
Let's talk about that. One of the wonderful things about your work and this book, which more because you get all of these stories and they represent so many different phases of your life, if you've done as much reading about you as I have and many of probably your constituents have, you do get a certain amount, the way we could with Truman Capote, of blending of fact and fiction, trying to figure out which of these things corresponds to which phase of your life. And I have to say that one of my favorite stories, in just the most evil way, it was like this sexed up Jane Austen House of Mirth moment for me with Edith Wharton, was a story from 2008 called Summary Judgment.
Ah, right.
And you're looking like, where is she going with this? Alicia DeSante. Who is a woman of a certain age, and it's the kind of woman that you think, can this really exist? This is a woman who would be like a stalking big game hunter of CEO, divorced or widowed, we hope, man, possibly married. All she wants is to, get ahead, climb the social ladder.
She wants a rich husband.
She wants a rich husband, and she's got a major mortgage.
She's a fortune hunter, yeah.
She is, and then I was reading this, I thought, you know what, this really sounds familiar to me. This story, and I thought about it, and because of an advanced age, it takes me a while to get my hands on these things, and I realized, Veronica Hurst, your stepmother-in-law. I mean, this is like the story of Veronica Hurst in Vanity Fair.
I don't know what would give you that idea.
but you know, what I think is great, my point is not even that that these things mirror certain aspects of your life. That there's a story about, it's called Sleeping with a Pig or In Bed with a Pig. And it's about a pot-bellied pig.
Sleeping with pigs.
Yeah. With pigs. Shared Jay McInerney's, the character's marital bed. But in fact, we know, if we read about you, that there was a pig in your life, an actual pig, not like an ex-wife or a bad girlfriend, but a pig that was in your... And so...
Yes, I was the other pig in the story.
You were. You were referred to as McSwine. But I guess my question is, when you are taking aspects of your life, some of which are really painful. This story, the Madonna of Turkey Season, which really resurrects a family very much like yours, a character who talks about a dying deathbed confession of their mother. And you, like the character in that story, your brother didn't speak to you for a year. So you're taking a lot of chances, it seems to me, with what you're doing.
Well, you did mention the two most autobiographical stories in the book, the Sleeping with Pigs and the Madonna of Turkey Season. And in fact, you know, I have to say that I, you know, there must have been some element of therapy in those stories. They were drawing on my life. In general, I have to say that one of the things I normally like about stories is that I'm getting outside of myself. I mean, a lot of these stories just start with an anecdote, something I hear at a party, something that I mull over. But yes, those two are fairly autobiographical, and one of them deals specifically with the ways that writers turn their experience into fiction or semi-fiction, as the case may be. It's about a playwright who writes about his family and causes a big fight at the Thanksgiving table. And it's an occupational hazard, I guess. And I can only say that I hope you're all lucky enough not to have a writer in the family.
Or maybe it'll be somebody who's writing historical fiction. But when you were here 3 years ago, we were talking about the couple Corrine and Russell Calloway, who appeared at that time for the third time in your work. It was mm-hmm. You were writing about The Good Life, but they actually had appeared before that, the first time, in a story called Smoke, mm-hmm. which is in this book also, a very early story, 1985. And then there's a separate story in this book that takes place, again, even further on. And I'm trying to remember what the name of that story. Oh, that's The March.
The March.
That's what you're going to read from. Okay. And so like this character, Alison Poole, who you revisit, you start with a story, you take it to a novel, and then there's another story. The fact that you have these characters that we can actually track them over so many years and so many events. It must be like they have held a very specific role in your life as a writer, more than anybody else, I think.
Yeah, this couple in particular, I something just stays with me about them. I think Russell Calloway is an editor at a publishing house in New York, and I think that when I started writing about him, he was kind of my alter ego in the sense that if I had had a slightly more conventional life, if I hadn't got a phone call from George Plimpton, and if I hadn't become a novelist, I think I somehow imagined that I might be an editor. So Russell, starting 25 years ago, was a projection of a more conventional life. If I had successfully stayed married to my college sweetheart, something that he did, and I suppose there's a bit of wish fulfillment in this marriage between these two, and they stayed with me, and I imagine I've written two novels about them, and I suspect I'll write a third, and that might be my 10th novel.
Well, they're like you're the rabbit for Updike, I guess, although you've said they're not really, but I mean you keep revisiting them the way you...
Yeah,
I
like the idea that they're sort of living an independent existence out there, and I can revisit them from time to time.
What's interesting is the first story, Smoke, sort of introduces them, and that's like the first time that they appear in your work. But then if you've read, whether they were in Brightness Falls, but then in the most recent book, in The Good Life, where that story ends, where Corrine has had this very passionate affair with Luke McGavick, and they met at Ground Zero, and so it brings together all these elements of, you know, sort of the latter part of your life rather than the early part of your life. And the story picks up just where you sort of left him off a couple years later. But you wrote this story at the same time that you were writing the book.
Yeah, I actually, this story was supposed to be part of the novel. And somehow it never found its way into the novel. For one thing, it takes place a year after the novel ends. I almost put a date on this story, and I didn't.
But, I noticed that. I thought there was a typo.
The story is set very specifically February 15th, 2003. And the reason that I almost put the date was that this was the actual day of a really, really, really big protest march in New York City against the upcoming Iraq War. And one of the reasons I wanted to write about it is because hardly anybody else did. That is to say, if you read, you had to turn to page 12 of the New York Times, and there was about three paragraphs about what must have been 500,000 people marching up Third Avenue. And it was a really interesting moment for me and a sad moment for me because the days after September 11th, New Yorkers were, you know, pulled together and developed a sense of community that I had never seen before. And to me, this kind of marked the end of it. You know, at one point we were all working together, literally and figuratively. I actually worked at a soup kitchen at Ground Zero for a number of weeks, and I really got to know the cops and the firemen. And then suddenly, here were the cops, like, sort of threatening us with billy clubs during this march. It was the end of a moment. And I decided that would be discordant in a way to have that in the book. And so this just floated around out there until I finished it as a story.
Well, if you would just read a little bit of that, please, because I was not seeing any of the politics and only thinking, are they going to get together again? Are they going to get together? So I was...
The march. Corrine had agreed to meet Washington and Veronica at the diner on 52nd Street, a place they'd come for hamburgers on Saturday or brunch on Sunday when they were living in the neighborhood back in the 80s. It had been more than a decade since she'd set foot there. And the glazed apple pies and coconut cakes under their plastic domes seemed like museum displays from the distant era of her lost youth. But now it was jammed with cops. She hadn't seen this many uniforms since her days at the soup kitchen downtown, feeding cops and firefighters and sandmen and steel workers who had come together in the smoking ruins. She'd gotten to know several cops then, but the cohort here today seemed less benign, their faces tight, closed and bolted against fraternization. That moment of solidarity, of strangers comforting one another in the streets, of stockbrokers hugging firemen and waving to cops, had already faded into history. The citizens of the metropolis were changed, though less tangibly than they might have imagined or hoped back in the time of anthrax and missing person posters. They had, most of them, been given a glimpse of their best selves and told themselves they wouldn't forget or go back to the old, selfish, closed-in ways. But then they'd gone back to work and the rubble had been carted away and the stock market had recovered. You woke up one morning not thinking about that terrible day, not remembering it had happened until perhaps seeing the tattered remains of an old poster on your way to lunch. And it felt good not to think about it all the damn time. She stepped outside to wait. Already at 10:30, the street was jammed with people bundled against the cold and carrying signs. All we are saying is give peace a chance. A little kid holding one that said, war is terror, and his sister in a red snowsuit with her own sign, draft the Bush twins. Russell had stayed home with the kids who were working on a play for her birthday. While he shared Corrine's feelings about the imminent war, Russell was not a joiner. I don't march, he'd said earlier in the morning, showing the same kind of contrarian pride he sometimes brought to the traditional refrain of, I don't dance. Looking south down the sidewalk for Washington and Veronica, she felt her chest tightened as she picked out a familiar figure, the loose, loping stride beneath the camel coat, the flopping, sandy forelock, a garment bag hanging on his shoulder like a vestigial wing. She waited, paralyzed at his approach, and watched the changes ring on his unguarded visage as he recognized her, the rapid modulation from shock to wistful chagrin that preceded his public, isn't this a pleasant surprise, mien. I might have known you'd be here, he said as he kissed her cheek.
You know, if anybody has questions, by the way, this is a good moment to come down to the microphones. But, you know, I know that your book, Brightness Falls, in which Corrine and Russell Calloway appear, it was one of your favorites. That was what you felt was one of your strongest books. And probably you also felt that way about about the good life. But you've said that, you know, your epitaph is never going to mention those. It's always going to mention Bright Lights,
Big City.
Well, I hope
it mentions them, maybe.
It won't be top billing. And I guess my question is, and it's a tough one, is, I mean, how do you feel about your literary legacy now? And you're obviously not done, but, you know, so much that everything that's mentioned about you is always starts with, you know, Bright Lights, Big City. Don't you get sick of it?
Well, yeah, once in a while I get sick of it. On the other hand, you know, I have to say that I'm proud of Bright Lights, Big City, and it gave me a career, really. You know, I mean, I'm one of the rare people who's lucky enough to make his living as a novelist, and that's a great gift. You know, that's the gift from Bright Lights, Big City, I guess. And at the same time, I think we're just finally getting distant enough from Bright Lights that I'm beginning to read some of the reviews of this book, because it is a retrospective and it sort of spans my whole career. I'm starting to see a little revisionism creep in. I'm starting to see there's a few things coming out this week, in fact, that suggest that perhaps my major achievements are some of the later works.
They're making a new, there's meant to be now a remake of the movie Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, that's true. I have to say that I'm not a big fan of the original movie, so I'm happy about the fact that it's being remade. I wrote the screenplay, so I can't really blame all of this on other people. But I'm not sure how it happened, because I was there for the whole thing. I was there every day. It looked like we were doing the right thing, but
it was the 80s.
It was the 80s.
We have a question here.
Yeah.
First, I just want to say that if you don't read your audiobooks, you should. You seem like you're very good.
Oh, thank you. I don't read my audiobooks, as a matter of fact.
But the more important question, I'm always curious that I seem to frequent a lot of message boards where there's a lot of anti-editor comments, and I think a good editor must be like the greatest thing in the world. Could you tell me a little bit about your relationship in terms of the details of how he actually works with the words and with you?
I think a good editor is really important, if only to sometimes say no. I'm really fortunate in that my editor is my college roommate. We went to Williams together, and after initially getting in a fist fight over a girl from Wellesley, we became great friends, and we pretty much grew up, as it were, reading the same stuff. We were trading books. You know, I would give him Raymond Carver's first book. He later became Carver's editor. We went to the same James Joyce class. So basically, he knows my taste. He knows my aspirations. We share the same taste to some extent. And so I have a kind of an unnatural advantage, I think, in a way. I'm very lucky. He can almost finish my sentences. And we do argue a lot, though. And one of the things I love about my editor is he will actually argue over a comma. He'll argue over a word. This is not the norm in publishing these days, I have to say. But at the end of the day, he always says, it's your name on the book. So I get the veto. But he is somebody who still really cares about language, and he won't let me be lazy. And sometimes it's a little painful. You know, I don't always like it when I get my galleys back, and there's this, you know, marginalia that goes, duh, you know, exclamation mark. You know, I can live without some of that, but but maybe he's right. I think that a good editor is just an extraordinary boon to a writer. But I have friends, particularly my English friends, who just think it's appalling that a writer would let anybody meddle with his work. You know, I feel lucky to have that.
Thank you. Let's see if we can get in one more question here.
Yes, you mentioned the author, Robert Stone. Could you elaborate on your friendship with him?
Well, Robert Stone, I read Dog Soldiers when I was at Williams. Again, a book that I shared with my editor. And I thought it was extraordinary. And I subsequently read everything of his that I could find. He was one of the great, you know, I think he is one of our greatest living novelists. And I was lucky enough to meet him later. And we've become pretty good friends. I always find him incredibly daunting because he's really smart, and you can never say lighten up to Robert Stone, but sometimes you'd like to. He's always operating, you know, at full intensity, and I'm always very nervous about showing him my work, but he was one of the first writers to really make sense of the Vietnam experience, I think, and he was one of the first writers who took the sensibility of the '60s and kind of integrated it with the American literary tradition of Hemingway. And if you don't know his work, I'd say, you know, I highly recommend it.
Well, now I'm going to lower the bar just a little bit in the last 5 minutes. One story we didn't get to talk about, but I want to make sure I get it in, is The Last Bachelor, which was actually the title of this book when it was published in Great Britain, and is the last story in the book and one of the most recent stories. And it concerns this middle-aged, aging Lothario who, unlike Jay here, has never been married, but is about to get married, but just can't resist that last little fling of just about everything on the night before his wedding. And I thought about that and about you've been married now to your fourth wife, Ann Hurst McInerney. And you wrote this a couple of years after you got married, and she's got to be extraordinary to read that story, know you, know your past.
Well.
And still live with you.
Well, she knows it's not me. She knows some of the prototypes for that story. There are a number of men about town in New York who aren't me. But I was fascinated by someone who had a very different life experience than my own. You know, I'm intrigued by the notion of a man who waits till he's 50 to get married for the first time. But again, this is my way of exploring a kind of a counter life, you know, the life that I didn't actually live, you know.
But does it bother you that people then do conflate these characters with you? In one of the reviews, they specifically singled out, I mean, people love that story, but one reviewer talked about, you know, the sadness in it and the sense of self-loathing. But the self-loathing she was referring to was your self-loathing, is the author's self-loathing. And that's just got to be really...
Well, I think, you know, that's a fallacy in the sense that, you know, she's forgetting the basic rules of how to read fiction, you know, is that, you know, even if something is written in the first person, it is not necessarily the author who is speaking. It's a persona. It's a character. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I write fiction is to get outside of myself and put myself in other people's shoes. I really like that story a lot, and I'm not sure that this character is entirely sympathetic, but
no, I wouldn't describe him as that.
Yeah,
but he was fascinating.
But I don't know. I think there's something, I find there's something interesting and vaguely heroic about someone who is that dedicated to sort of the myth of his own youth and his own pleasure and so on. And ultimately, there's something really tragic about this character. I mean, I don't know that self-loathing is the right phrase, but there's just a real tragedy to a somewhat misdirected life.
I would say that, for the most part, the stories are all sort of tinged with some kind of either tragedy or loneliness or guilt. Or, I mean, they're not It's not like reading Flannery O'Connor or something, but they're, I can't look at any of these stories as going, you don't come out at the end going, wow, you know, so uplifting, isn't that great? He gets the girl, or the girl gets him, or whatever. It's, but they're wonderful. I really enjoy it.
Well, an upcoming review suggests that it's the Celtic sensibility, the sense
Celtic?
Of, yeah, the sense of guilt and the Catholic guilt and and melancholy. So perhaps that's what you're sensing.
Well, I don't know if you can do this in just the last minute or so, but I would have to think that because you've been chronicling New York when it was like the city on the go and on the make and everything was just going great guns, that now that the city has, that we've had this incredible financial situation in the last year, that that's going to be wonderful new territory for future work of yours.
It is, yes. It's fascinating to watch the city readjusting to the new economy. And you know, frankly, it's also, there's something wonderful about it for me in that, you know, when I went to the city, it was a city of bohemians and sort of, it was gritty and it was affordable and it was a place where poets and ballet dancers and, you know, aspiring editors could go and afford an apartment in a crummy neighborhood. And somewhere along the line, the investment bankers took over the soul of the city that I love. And I'm kind of hoping that that era is over. And I'm looking forward to the new one.
Well, we hope to see you back here in 3 years, and I hope at that time I can still say you've only been married 4 times. You're not actually pursuing Norman Mailer now.
As your... Yeah, that's one record of Norman's that I'm not going after.
Good one. I like that role model.
Hemingway stopped at 4.
Good place. You're in a good place. Jay, it's been a pleasure again. Thank you so much, Jay McInerney, for coming to Writers on the Record and
Thank
to all
Victoria.
Of you. See you next month for Eric Bogosian. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Our special thanks to everyone associated with the series at the Chicago Public Library, at the Harold Washington Library Center, including Commissioner Mary Dempsey. Engineers for the broadcast are Eric Arunas and Leland Mosley. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Seminary Co-op Bookstores are widely admired because this consumer-owned bookstore is actually 3 Chicago bookstores, the flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue, and one of the world's best academic bookstores, carries about 200,000 titles. Currently, they recommend The Hindus, an alternative history by Wendy Doniger, published by Penguin Press. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a charming neighborhood bookstore that's featuring family properties, race, real estate, and the exploitation of black urban America by Beryl Satter, published by Metropolitan Books. And the Newberry Library Bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in cartography, music, history, cards, and gifts. There, you're invited to discover The Library at Night by Alberto Mangel, new in paperback from Yale University Press. Enjoy Seminary Co-op Bookstore's 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, and author events. Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456 and at semcoop.com. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago.